This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy, and welcome to the Illinois Wesleyan University Schurch Center and the Illinois Sustainable Living and Wellness Expo. GLT, the Ecology Action Center, and IWU are partnering to bring you this climate change roundtable for a second year. A couple of important markers as we undertake this roundtable for a second year. Chicago had its first snowless January and February in 146 years since records have been kept. And there was a presidential election. The winning candidate has called climate change a hoax, and his policies reflect that attitude. During this edition of Sound Ideas, which we're calling Climate Change and Community Action, we'll explore how things are changing on the federal level and what local communities can do as the feds pull back. Joining us today on this on-location edition of Sound Ideas are five guests. Dr. William Rao is a professor emeritus of industrial sociology at Illinois State University. His longstanding interest in energy and industry drives his continued involvement in the community. Dave Holmquist is the Great Lakes coordinator with the Citizens Climate Lobby. The Citizens Climate Lobby is lobbying for legislation creating a fee on fossil fuels and a resulting dividend to homeowners. Shannon Fulton is the Director of Business Development for Straight Up Solar, involved in a partnership with the Ecology Action Center and the Midwest Renewable Energy Association last year that helped home and business owners in Bloomington Normal to pool their buying power to secure discounts that made installing solar more affordable than ever. And finally, two guests with whom Sound Ideas listeners are very familiar. They're regulars on the show most Tuesdays following their Monday evening council meetings, Town of Normal Mayor Chris Coos and Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Thanks to all of you for coming in today and for your time. We appreciate it. Bill Rao, let's start with you. Help set the stage for us. Last year, we were talking about the Paris Climate Accord. This year, we're wondering if it'll be honored. What are your top three concerns today? Maybe some things you weren't worried about as it concerned climate change last year.
Well, I think it's important to move forward on the local and state level with climate change initiatives. And so for our particular area, I would love to see the cities of Bloomington and Normal commit to a getting to 100 by 2030 initiative. And that would be 100% renewable energy, preferably with Maiden-McLean County wind and solar. So that would be one. I would love to see a comprehensive energy efficiency initiative across the cities. Energy efficiency typically pays for itself. It's one of the few areas where you actually get a free lunch. And third, I'd like to see us tackle the problem of fuel poverty, where you have low-income folks that are paying 20-25% of their total disposable income on utility bills, and it's crushing for these families. So we need to deal with that, and I think we can under the Solar for All program that has just been passed under the Future Energy Jobs.
And we'll get into Solar for All a little later.
So those would be my three.
Mayor Terry Renner, what are some of your concerns as it concerns climate change? And you heard what Bill had to say about trying to get to 100% renewable energy use in our community. Is that possible?
I think it's possible. I certainly would like to work with Bill and our city council and legal in moving that forward. I think that would be a very admirable goal. My biggest concern about climate change is that there are so many, there's a minority of people in our country primarily who are still in denial about it. And facts matter. Reality and truth matters. Now, science is something that many people are now questioning, debunking, but that's one of the things that really worries me. I was very honored to work with Mayor Coos on Complete Streets, and not only in both of our communities, but we, including the mayor of Portland, Oregon, Charlie Hales, co-sponsored a resolution for Complete Streets that was passed unanimously at the U.S. Conference of Mayors last June. And that's really important because this is telling us what 21st century, 22nd century cities are going to look like. So Complete Streets, where you're accommodating pedestrians, bicycles, mass transit, as well as automobiles. And so I think that's another critical piece.
And we'll drill down into Complete Streets a little later as well. Okay. Mayor Chris Coos, mayor of the Town of Normal, some of your concerns as it concerns climate change, maybe some things that you weren't concerned about a year ago that you are concerned about today.
Well, I'm going to echo what Terry said and not say it because you just did. But I think it's spot on that the mayors in the United States are taking this issue in a proactive way. They're doing things in their community to make their communities more environmentally responsible and to do things to address climate change through policies in the communities. And I think that's That's a positive thing that's happening. It was started by the mayor of Seattle, Washington, a few years back when the United States did not adopt the Kyoto Accords, and he said, well, if you, this country's not going to do it, the mayors are going to do it. And I think 225 mayors in the United States signed up for that. So those are some of the issues, and also the notion that there's some strength in our Congress right now to deny climate change. And I'll be cynical about that and say that it's likely being driven by money. And it's an issue that we're going to have to address.
Do you think, a quick follow-up for both mayors, do you think the rubber is really going to meet the road locally as it concerns addressing climate change in the next 4 years or maybe the next 2 years?
I think Mayor Coos and I would do anything we possibly can. I think that's absolutely critical.
Is that where the action has to take place, though?
Probably in the next 4 years, I would guess that's the case. I don't think you're going to see much progress at the national level in change. In fact, I think it may very well be in the reverse direction. And again, mayors have to actually make things happen where the tire hits the pavement. If we blither on and filibuster like they do in our state capitals or in Washington, the problem gets worse and we got a bigger mess to clean up. And so when you're a practical problem solver, again, you go back to this, the vote last summer on complete streets, there was not one metro mayor who voted no. And these were Democrats, Republicans, people across the board. They realize that this is critical for the 21st century. And so, again, mayors deal with the real world. There are people who are conspiracy theorists, who are making things up, who don't believe in science, that are frankly very serious problems for our, not just our country, our community.
Or as Mayor Coos pointed out, the decisions are being driven by lobbying dollars.
Right. And just to give one anecdote, and I'm going to turn it over to Chris, and that is, it just before David Cameron, the head, and I can't remember his name, the head of the Conservative Party in Great Britain, so nobody's left-wing radical, addressed the United Nations and said the most important issue facing humanity right now is global warming and climate change, and got a standing ovation. Right. I think we have to realize that facts matter. And, you know, the policies may not be comfortable, and there are going to be some powerful special interests that we have to be prepared to take on.
Shannon Fulton with Straight Up Solar. Just before I ask you about your top three concerns, let me ask you to build upon what Mayor Renner said. Is it the top issue facing the globe? Is climate change the overriding issue, you think?
I certainly think it is. There are threads that export from that concept that impact every aspect of our life, and not only here in the U.S., but across the world. We're seeing droughts and food shortage and all these other issues that create conflict among humans. And so it's a far bigger issue than just, do we have appropriate incentives for solar in Bloomington Normal or the state of Illinois? It's a much bigger issue, and I absolutely think it's at the
And more specifically, what are some of your concerns that maybe this year you didn't have last year?
Well, I have to go in the other direction. I think that luckily in Illinois, we have quite a very positive outlook for renewable energy. Luckily, renewable energy policies are set primarily on a state level. And even though our administration in the state of Illinois is typically, you would think, would be pretty much anti-renewable energy, when in fact we just passed a monumental energy bill that stands up renewable energy through 2030 in a really progressive way. So luckily, on a state level, we are doing far more positive things that just give me a lot of really wonderful hope.
Illinois does appear to be taking a leadership position at the
Absolutely.
State level, and we'll get into that act that was passed in December in a little bit. Dave Holmquist with the Citizens Climate Lobby, same question. Your concerns as it concerns global warming and climate change?
Well, I think one of my main concerns is the pace at which climate change is bearing down on us. It's a concern that I had last year. It's more deeply felt this year.
It's accelerating.
It's accelerating. When you're seeing 50-degree temperature anomalies in the Arctic, we have some serious problems to deal with and some risks of runaway climate change. I'm also concerned about what I sense is a disengagement from the national political scene on this. I don't think that the risk that people will disengage. It's certainly important to move climate action to the state and municipal level. There are lots of things that are being enabled there, lots of progress being made, but there are hopeful signs as well at the national level, and I hope people don't engage. That's the level where I work, where Citizens Climate has worked for a number of years, Citizens Climate Lobby, and we see some progress actually since the election, which I'd be happy to talk about later. And the third thing that, that concerns me is, it's a concern and a hopeful concern, again, is to see the debate that's arising, the debate and the movement toward intersectionality in the climate movement. That is, alliances being made between mainstream environmental groups and the environmental justice movement. Alliances being made that take a much more holistic approach to the issue. I'm concerned that we pay adequate attention to the needs of frontline communities and the environmental justice movement.
And I'm just curious, anyone can jump in here, when you see the White House start to pull back on some of the things the Obama administration was doing to address climate change, what's your reaction? Do you just shake your heads? Does it make you more resolved to do things locally, Bill?
Well, one of the things I would approach is, I think some of the Trump administration's position for coal, for example, are laughable. It's clear that they have the ability to do a lot of damage, but to bail out coal, they would have to provide massive subsidies to coal operations, and I don't see that happening. What is really dictating things right now is a very major breakthrough in price of both first wind, now solar, and the next will be batteries, such that the incumbent fossil fuel power producers and the nuclear power producers can no longer compete in an open market. And so one of the real battles occurring nationwide now is whether or not we're going to provide subsidies, for example, to nuclear power plants that can no longer compete. It's an issue in a number of states.
So the whole economy is changing.
Yeah, the whole economy has changed, and it's basically a no-brainer now to move to basically wind and solar. So that's a really important thing, because you know we're essentially pragmatic people financially, and
Mayor
so
Renner.
We'll carry the day.
And
Mayor
that's going to turn, you know, as a political scientist, not necessarily just a mayor speaking, is that that's going to turn some of the traditional debates on their head, because people have groused about subsidizing solar, electric car tax credits, et cetera, that is infringing on the free market. And now it'll be interesting to see what they say if we're going to need to subsidize the fossil fuel industry.
There was some good news late last year as in the Illinois General Assembly, as Shannon alluded to. The Illinois General Assembly passed. Governor Rauner signed the Future Energy Jobs Bill. Shannon Fulton with Straight Up Solar. Can you talk about the Future Energy Jobs Bill and what that means for the people of Illinois? Maybe begin with something Bill said. There is a subsidy in there for nuclear power, correct?
That's correct. So that bill had major bipartisan support, So I've been president of the Illinois Solar Energy Association for the past few years as well, and in my experience with that solar nonprofit, there was never a time prior where legislators really took us seriously. And it was this opportunity where the environmental justice groups and renewable energy groups, environmental organizations, Environmental Law Policy Center came together and formed such a coalition that the legislators, these that signed on both on both sides of the aisle, would not make decisions without us at the table. So that not only was it an historic bill that propped up renewable energy and energy efficiency measures, but it also went a long way to actually establish things like a true value of solar, a utility recognized value of solar. I would say that, you know, it's going to create tens of thousands of jobs, and we have goals to grow from 60 megawatts in the state right now to 1,350 megawatts by 2020. There are already national...
Can you put that into some perspective, maybe per household? What does that mean for homes, or is there a per household breakdown of those megawatts?
Most of those, there is. I don't have it on the top of my head, but a lot of that growth is going to happen in the way of community solar, distributed generation, some utility scale as well. We have national level companies already operating in the state, ready to hire people and install solar.
Why didn't the what changed? You said the lawmakers didn't take it seriously before. Now they are. You have a seat at the table. What flipped?
We just banded together instead of working independently. Those voices and the validity behind those voices get lost when you isolate yourselves. And the industry, the solar and wind industry, green jobs advocates, and the environmental justice, the community groups made a huge difference.
And how did politics not get in the way? We've heard here about how maybe money is driving political decisions.
Sure.
As it concerns climate change. How did politics not get in the way of this particular bill in Illinois?
Well, it did get in the way. This took 2 years to happen. It didn't just happen in the last few months of session. However, the reason that it was, I think one of the reasons it was so broadly popular was because there were hundreds of people who were going to lose their jobs if those nuclear plants closed. So you have, you know, conservatives or Republicans and Democrats alike who don't want people to lose their jobs, right? So there was this coming together of, people getting what they want, and it was a large compromise.
And Bill, there's something you want to say, Bill?
Yeah,
Rao.
One of the interesting things here is a lawsuit has been filed against the Exelon bailout, and if legal precedent holds, Exelon will lose that lawsuit. Fortunately, the bill is severable, so if they lose their bailout, the rest of the bills remain intact. That would be the best of all possible worlds, and it's a distinct possibility that'll happen. The Supreme Court ruled 9-0 on an earlier case on the kind of bailout scheme they have at work here. So law is on the side of the people who are filing a lawsuit against Exelon.
Despite the job savings quality of the bailout, was that the bitter pill for you, for everyone at this table?
The
nuclear piece?
Absolutely.
Yeah. For the first time in state history, there are more solar-related jobs in the state than coal-related jobs. In 2016, the coal industry shed about 1,200 jobs, stands at about 2,800 in the state. Earlier this month, the nonprofit Solar Foundation released a report showing 3,700 people employed in solar in Illinois. Shannon, where is it headed?
We're
going to
see amazing growth. Actually, one of the major challenges to meeting the goals of the Future Energy Jobs Act is having enough capacity in Illinois to build the solar that we need to build within those capacity guidelines at 1,350 megawatts. It's going to be tough to meet.
And net metering was preserved in the Future Energy Jobs Bill. This essentially turns every home or business into a solar energy producing factory of its own. Are we talking about significant savings from net metering for individual homeowners? And how much energy do you think will be fed back into the system?
Well, right now, I think we're at 0.4% total renewable energy on our grid in Illinois. The Future Energy Jobs Act incorporates a trigger of 5% penetration on our grid, at which point the Illinois Commerce Commission will do a study to actually evaluate an offset rebate or offset value to net metering. So at some point, at about 5% penetration on the grid, net metering will go away. But the great thing about that is, I mean, we may fear that loss, but what that in a sense does is it documents that the utilities agree that there is an added value to their grid by adding distributed generation, solar. And that that doesn't happen very often that they'll admit to that.
Will you circle back to try to get that provision back in net metering? Is there a way to do
that? Probably not. The solar industry isn't too worried about losing net metering at 5%. We're looking at anywhere from, you know, maybe 5 years or so down the road. And by that time, the cost of solar technology will have dropped and we'll have community solar and other options for people to support renewable energy.
Bill Rao, last year we talked about community solar gardens, and they were dependent upon the future of the Future Energy Bill. these solar gardens are included in this bill. What will it take to create some of those opportunities in Bloomington Normal?
Okay, first of all, two things. Net metering is only for residential solar. It doesn't apply to community solar, by the way. And community solar is limited to the low-income solar provisions. Ameren, for example, could still allow community solar if they wanted to do so, but that's a real iffy question. But under the Future Energy Job Build, my guess is that Bloomington Normal will get somewhere around 7 megawatts of solar between 2018 and the end of 2020. That would allow about 2.5 megawatts for community solar that could be built on brownfield sites in this town. And that by way of virtual metering, those benefits would go to low-income participants who bought solar shares. And the upfront cost of that would be covered by the Illinois Power Agency. So the major barrier to low-income participation in solar has been eliminated under this bill, which is really a really important breakthrough.
And what effect do you think it'll have on home energy use across the community, mainly in lower-income neighborhoods or lower-income
households? Well, it can start there, but there's no reason why other members of the community can't build solar. I would like to see solar done sociologically, which is what straight up solar does. And the way you do solar sociologically is, number one, you get a number of people to do solar using a standardized design, a cookie cutter design. Secondly, where you have someone who's a nonprofit or a church, you bring in a private equity group to capitalize on the tax benefits for you. And you build in sufficient scale that you get a discount. So if you look at the price differential between rooftop solar and utility scale solar, it's about 50%. So if you get those economies of scale, which you could do if we had a collective plan where we pool projects together, we could get solar down to the point where we're probably talking about 6 cent or 7 cent solar. Now we're talking about really big savings.
And what would those savings look like on an individual, for an individual average household?
Okay, let's assume, let's say net metering is gone, and we're at a point where people self-consume all of the energy they produce. So first of all, you're not paying for the power, and you're not paying for the distribution. We're paying 12 cents a kilowatt hour right now. So if you can get solar down to, say, like 10 cents a kilowatt hour, people are coming out 20% ahead. The key is to self-consumption, and I think that with the solar storage, battery storage dropping like a rock, another 5 years from now, Shannon, you could correct me here, I think you're going to see the standard package will be solar plus storage, possibly even with a little nano grid built into your house so that if the big grid goes down, you can run off your old solar. I think that this is in the cards. It's only a question when it's going to happen, and more and more people will have solar because it's economically the smart thing to do.
You mentioned brownfield sites. Yeah. Is finding land an obstacle for establishing these community solar gardens? And is this something that we have both mayors here? Is this something that the municipalities could help with finding land? There's all kinds of public land that's not really, you know, good for public use, but might work for a solar farm.
Right. Let me give a couple examples. You have the old Chicago and Alton yard on the west side, 47 acres. You've got the Republic landfill, which will be closing soon, 63 acres. You have about 5 acres behind the Bloomington Reclamation water plant. You've got these, take GE over there. There's about 10 acres sitting over there. It's been abandoned for 10 years.
You're talking about GE Road,
the corner of
Veterans Parkway.
Yeah, the old ballast plant. There's a big chunk of land there, and they've got a substation there. You've got the old telephone building that was torn down. There's 7 acres there. There are places scattered all over town where we've got large pieces of land that are just sitting there, not being used. Sometimes they're contaminated. Sometimes there's just no prospects for development. Well, those are perfect sites to build low-cost solar, because what you want to do is have a cookie-cutter design that's ground-mounted so you can put in a whole bunch of 100-kilowatt or 500-kilowatt units spread across the city, so you've got basically a plug-and-play into the grid.
Mayor Coos?
This is something we looked at, and we were probably ahead of the game a little bit working with an energy company when we first started doing uptown redevelopment. And the notion was at least in power generation, was why not roof all your parking decks with solar arrays? And that would work very well, and that's something we'll probably circle back to as well. But also, as Bill pointed out, how many surface parking lots do we have in this community that you could roof with a solar array? People would park out of the weather for their car, and you'd have incredible opportunity to build solar arrays throughout the community.
Well, many of those parking lots are empty the majority of the time. You could just put them in the parking lot, I suppose, too.
If you have your canopy, you're also keeping that car cool in the summer.
Sure.
So cutting your air conditioning bill, future fossil fuel consumption.
Can we put bike racks under the canopies, too?
We could do that.
Okay.
just a couple.
EV charging stations. What are you hearing, Mayor Renner, about this in this conversation? And are the wheels turning here in terms of where we could put community solar in Bloomington?
And the types of things that Chris mentioned are absolutely possible. It doesn't have to be a singular site. We actually did have a Chinese company, I guess it was about 2.5 years ago, who was very seriously interested in establishing the largest solar field in the Midwest outside, except for Indianapolis. At the end of the day, we didn't get that contract, but it was going to be south of where the airport is currently right now. So it's not like McLean County has a shortage of land.
Or sunshine. Lately, it seems that way.
Maybe not always in January and February.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy at the Illinois Wesleyan University Shirk Center for the Illinois Sustainable Living and Wellness Expo panel discussion, Climate Change and Community Action. Joining me are Bill Rao, Shannon Fulton with Straight Up Solar, Dave Holmquist is with the Citizens Climate Lobby, and let's stay with our community's mayors for a moment. In 2014, the U.S. Conference of Mayors signed the latest version of the Climate Protection Agreement. Endorsed by over 1,000 mayors, it supports a national goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 80% from 1990 levels by 2050, among other things. Were you a supporter and why? Mayor Coos?
Yes, I was a supporter. The why is simple. I mean, it's the culture that I live in, the culture of our community. So it was a very easy decision to make to support that. It's the long view. It goes to what we're talking about here today. So that was a very easy choice. And you will see that from almost all these mayors that did that, Republican and Democrat. It's a pragmatic approach.
Mayor Renner.
I would agree it was easy, and for the very same reasons that Mayor Coos has mentioned, it is absolutely a pragmatic approach. And as I mentioned earlier, mayors do have to deal with evidence. So that is one of the things that we can understand. Mayors really understand them. Actually, when you go to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, it's almost, even if you've never met them, it's almost like a fraternity club, and you're joined at the hip because you actually have to do things. And it's very much results-oriented. Do this, boom, boom, boom. If your city looks like this, maybe don't try that. It's results-oriented, and there aren't many philosophical debates at the U.S. Conference of Mayors. We want to make stuff happen.
Can either one of you talk about how this plan to reduce emissions by 80% in our community sort of is overarching or in the back of your mind as you approach your duties as mayor? Does it come up regularly?
I think it comes up, from my perspective, I'm sure Chris is the same way. It comes up all the time in either development or developing plans for a new library, developing other plans for our downtown or what we might call underperforming areas. It was certainly an issue in the Greentop grocery facility that's now just about to be opened, and even in the design and redesign of many of the buildings in Empire Crossing and Hy-Vee. So, and in Ovation Cinema as well. So, absolutely. It's on our mind all the time.
Did it enter into the equation when the town of Normal enacted its resolution for complete streets?
Ask that a different way.
Did the effort by the U.S. Conference of Mayors to reduce emissions by 80%, the accord that mayors, including yourself, signed on to, enter into the decision when you were thinking about complete streets?
Of course it did, yeah. It's even more complete in complete streets that when you take that into account.
How do you think complete streets will actually help reduce emissions?
Well, in the sense that it encourages multiple forms of transportation, be it pedestrian, cycling, transit, by making those on a level playing field with the automobile. And more people are going to take advantage of that. so it, people feel safe and they feel that their mode of transportation is safe and accessible, then they're going to use it more, their preferred choice. And then we've got a whole nother discussion for maybe for another day concerning complete streets, and that's autonomous vehicles.
Mayor Renner, same question.
I couldn't have. Once again, I agree with my distinguished colleague from Normal on everything, and for all the same reasons. Absolutely, and that does it is something that's the wave of the future. As we do see, millennials, for example, are much less likely to be automobile centric. I mean, I have more than my share of midlife crisis cars, but I'm from a different generation, and that's not the case as we go, you know, moving forward. So, absolutely, for all the reasons Mayor Kuz said.
You mentioned a library. Bloomington is looking at doing something with its library, either reconstructing or building a new one. The town of Normal is on a path to build, most likely build a new one, and the trajectory is toward the Living Buildings Challenge, which is pretty ambitious.
Actually, it's the Living Communities Challenge.
Living Community Challenge, okay.
It came out of the organization that did that, and it's kind of net zero on steroids, and it's something that we're looking at. There are two test cities in the United States that this group is working with, Portland, Oregon, and Normal, Illinois, to test out some of these theories where all the energy needs are dealt with on-site and possibly generating more power than it consumes. It has to do with wastewater management on-site, rainwater management on site, and it's something we think the library is a good place to work with this because it, you know, it's newer technologies, it's forward thinking, and so it's a very powerful educational tool.
Do you envision that library, if you're able to meet those goals, being a one-off building, or do you think that might be the first of maybe several in Uptown 2.0 and Uptown South?
Well, again, Uptown South is designated as a living building challenges, a living community challenge. So we would like to see it in that whole Uptown South area, whether it's office buildings, retail buildings, residential. Whatever comes, you know, we're a long way away from doing this, but it's kind of our goal to see if we can do this and afford it, what the payback is for the higher upfront costs.
The town was a leader in electric vehicles. You had the EV Town Initiative. We still see a lot of electric vehicles on the street in this community. What's the status of EV Town at this point?
EV Town kind of went on a hiatus. They accomplished a lot of things in the community. Getting awareness for electric vehicles in the community, the number of charging stations. We probably have more charging stations in Normal than St. Louis has or Cincinnati has. So we've got strong infrastructure. With the advent of Rivian Automotive coming back into the community, it's kind of drawn new interest into EV Town, so I think you're going to see them.
We might see a resurgence in EV Town.
Yeah, working with Rivian to revitalize that program.
The Ecology Action Center is in the middle of their second greenhouse gas emissions inventory for the city and the town, which will be followed by a community strategic planning process to reduce emissions. Both the town and the city have agreed to help fund this inventory and the plan. Why is this important to Bloomington Normal, and how do you think it might help in terms of reducing emissions? Mayor Renner?
Well, obviously, at the very least, you need to know, have benchmarks, and know if you're making progress. Are you going forward? Are you going backward? So I think that that's really critical. We had, in the city council, it was an 8-1 vote to pursue this in the future. And actually, the one no vote is not going to be returning. So I think we're going to have a situation where we are all going to be pushing for this, and we want that update.
Mayor Kuz.
Exactly what Terry said. If you can't measure it, how do you know if you're doing it?
This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org. I'm Mike McCurdy. Dave Holmquist is the Great Lakes Regional Coordinator for the Citizens Climate Lobby. The CCL is lobbying for legislation creating a fee on fossil fuels and a resulting dividend to homeowners. President Trump, for a few days, talked about a carbon tax. That seems to be off the table now as the GOP starts to address what they're calling comprehensive tax reform. Before we get to the CCL fee and dividend model, what is a carbon tax? How does that work?
Well, a carbon tax can come in various different forms. It could be a gasoline tax or a fee on utility bills. The way Citizens Climate Lobby conceives it is what we refer to as an upstream tax on the fuel itself. It's levied on the producer of the fuel as close to the point of extraction as possible. So there are various ways to design a carbon tax. Some of them are regressive in terms of their impact on people. Some of them are more effective than others.
So how does the CCL fee and dividend work?
Well, as I said, it's levied upstream. It's based upon the amount of greenhouse gas that's emitted when the fuel is burned. And we know what that is for various grades of coal, for natural gas, for different types of oil products. That's a matter of science. So it would be levied by the Treasury. The money would be deposited in a trust fund. And from there, that trust fund would be administered probably by the Social Security Administration or maybe a contractor brought on by the Social Security Administration. But the Social Security Administration has information on the composition of American households. You refer to American homeowners as the dividend recipients.
Households.
It's actually households, yes. So it would, and the dividend is distributed on an equal basis. So a carbon tax that would otherwise be regressive, the regressivity is removed from it because lower income people spend a larger percentage of their income on energy related expenses. So when you distribute it equally across the population, what happens, according to most of the modeling, is that the bottom two thirds of the income distribution receive more in the dividend than they experience in direct and embedded energy costs.
And how does it reduce fossil fuel use?
Well, the tax is designed, or the fee, we refer to it as a fee because when the money is returned to the people and not spent by the government, it technically is not a tax. If you want to refer to it as a tax, you'd refer to it as revenue neutral, which is a term of art for Republicans. They will not support a tax that is not revenue neutral. And that's part of the reason for the design of the system. Your question again.
The question was, how does it reduce fossil fuel use?
The fee starts low at $15 per ton, and it goes up $10 per ton per year on a predictable basis. It's statutory. It's not subject to sunset. And it continues to go up until we've reduced emissions to 10% of 1990 levels. That's our goal. So it gives a clear indication to investors, and this is even more important than changing individual behavior, is changing the behavior of investors in fossil fuel or in power generation infrastructure, in long-term investments for battery storage, which Bill mentioned, for electric vehicles, for all of the things that are needed to really transform the economy. It gives a huge jump start. This is a big program that provides a predictable path for fossil energy prices that allows investors to make rational decisions that they can count on.
Do you have an estimation of what sort of dividend a household might see? And I would imagine any money coming to these individuals is going to give a boost to the economy.
Yes. Again, a carbon tax without a dividend is a drag on the economy. With the dividend, it's mildly stimulative. It would start at about, under CCL's plan, it would start at about $50 per month for a household, for an average household of two adults and two children. 20 years out, it would be roughly $500 per month. So it starts out being a dinner out, and it ends up being a couple car payments.
And if someone wants to get involved, how do they jump on board?
We're hoping to form a local chapter here in Normal. They can go to citizensclimatelobby.org to get information or to join our mailing list as a supporter.
This is a lot of one-on-one sort of interaction with lawmakers to try to get this to happen. How have things been going with trying to get this this plan implemented since the November election?
Actually, we've had really hopeful signs since the election. After the election, we had six Republican members of the of what's called the climate Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus. It's a caucus that CCL helped to form in the House of Representatives. Since then, we've added 13 members, Republican members, to that caucus. We expected after the election that the Republican members of the House, particularly, wouldn't have much interest in talking to us about our proposal. And we've been talking to the Republicans about this for 7 years since they took control of the House, and when we realized that they would have control for a decade. And we expected that they would not be interested in talking to us so much anymore since the administration appeared to be determined to take climate change off the table. But that's not what's happened. And it's been borne out. They were engaged on the topic. No one turned us away. And it's been borne out by the growth of this Climate Solutions Caucus.
And Shannon Fulton, someone wants to jump on board solar. How do they get involved in getting solar at their house? And it's becoming less expensive, too, to do that, right?
Yes, it certainly is. I would recommend that anybody who's interested in learning more about solar, specifically in Illinois, become a member of the Illinois Solar Energy Association. It's just illinoisolar.org. And you can also contact me at Straight Up Solar, 844-97-SOLAR, if you're interested in getting a free estimate or just more information about how solar works.
What's happening with the cost of solar panels?
They're dropping markedly. But from an installer's perspective, we're seeing shortages, frankly. For example, China has such incredible goals, renewable energy goals, that we've recently seen, as a company, the larger solar panels that are used, for instance, for utility scale and commercial scale developments, being manufactured in China and staying in China. They're no longer wanting to export those because they have such a demand in country. And, you know, that may increase opportunity for domestic production. There are a few solar manufacturers in the U.S., but, you know, we were seeing the cost per watt for a solar panel at the mid 40 cents per watt. And that dropped from 70 cents per watt within the same year. So there's a lot of fluctuation in pricing, but also even more fluctuation in the capability to get those panels in the U.S.
Is the shortage slowing down your ability to install solar?
It's definitely having an impact on us,
so people,
on our
people
larger
having
projects.
To wait longer to get their projects finished.
Right.
What's the lifespan of that infrastructure, you know, that someone may have installed in their on their property, on their roof? Mm-hmm. How long does it last?
The solar production warranties for a typical solar panel are at 25 years. So this is a low, this is a long-term investment and low risk. And the inverter, the other component in a solar installation, the inverter that converts DC energy produced by the panels to AC energy used in the home, has a 10-year warranty. So you will expect to replace an inverter at some point throughout the life of your solar system. But these systems have been shown across the world, in the U.S. and across the world, to produce at 80%+, well beyond 30 years. So this is a long-lived, very robust technology.
Does it take 25 or 30 years to get your return on investment?
No. In fact, Bill mentioned the cost per kilowatt hour that we're paying, anywhere from 10 to 12 cents per kilowatt hour in this region. It takes about 5 to 7 years to pay back right now.
Illinois Solar for All is part of the Illinois Future Energy Jobs Bill. That's not the same thing as community solar gardens, or is it?
There's some nuance there. Community solar is accessible and doable for not just low-income communities. It's a concept that it's a minimum of a 300 kilowatt system. A church community can do it, a school district, a municipality, any quote-unquote community. It takes three people, basically, as far as the Future Energy Jobs Act is concerned, three people minimum for it to be classified as a community solar project. And so there are wonderful opportunities for the low-income population to finally be able to receive the benefits of solar energy, though. It's definitely a groundbreaking mechanism for the low-income population.
This is Sound Ideas on GLT and the Climate Change and Community Action Roundtable at the Illinois Sustainable Living and Wellness Expo. Bill Rao, we've heard about the economic and jobs benefit of clean energy in Illinois. Trump is pointing the federal government in the opposite direction. You called his policies on coal laughable. What real effect will his policies have on getting miners back to work in mines and coal workers back to work in coal?
Let's back up and look at this a little historically. If anyone had a war on coal, it was Ronald Reagan. If we look at the actual reduction in coal miners' jobs, because when Reagan took office, there were over 300,000 miners. By the time that Bush left office, there were, I think, 150,000. So what has happened in coal is, starting with the UMW, there was basically a bargain. We'll trade jobs for high wages. And so coal's been on a technology rip for a long, long, long time, and that's still continuing. So the simple fact of the matter is that in the East Coast, for example, those West Virginia miners are in really tough straits because, if nothing else, it's a lot cheaper to mine coal in Illinois. So a lot of the decline in coal mining in Appalachia hasn't been driven by any federal policies at all. It's been driven by the fact that Illinois coal is 40% cheaper than Appalachian coal. And since the coal-fired power plants in the East Coast have scrubbers, they don't care about sulfur. So the future for coal is bleak. The simple fact of the matter is that wind and solar is cheaper. Coal cannot compete. The only way it can survive is with subsidies. And are Americans willing to pay subsidies for a power plant that produces very large quantities of radioactive materials that go into the air, mercury, sulfur, all sorts of nasty stuff? And we're just talking about what goes in there and not what they're doing to the ground. Coal simply has no future.
So if it's not being subsidized, the big energy producers simply aren't choosing it either, aren't they?
Right.
Aren't they gravitating to at least going to natural gas?
Yes. A lot of, and even natural gas is in trouble. Most people don't realize this, but some natural gas plants in Texas and California are running into problems because what you have in Texas is the same thing you have in Illinois. You have a deregulated energy market. The cheapest energy is bought first. The cheapest energy is wind. So it's driving coal and natural gas out of business in Texas.
In addition to an executive order dealing specifically with coal, the president is also rolling back President Obama's Clean Power Plan. What are the effects of killing this plan?
Let me say that the most important thing fueling a transition to renewable energy is the investment tax credit and the production tax credit. People did some studies on this, and there was a bipartisan agreement in 2015 to extend those tax credits to wind and solar, and they're leading to very large bills of both. So they're actually, in a sense, tax credits in some sense are more important than the Clean Power Plan in my book. But it will have scuttling the Clean Power Plan will have an adverse impact. It really clearly will have, and it's very, very unfortunate. We need that federal regulatory certainty to help speed up the transition, particularly in recalcitrant states that are still committed to fossil fuels. That's where the Clean Power Plan would have an impact in places like West Virginia, Pennsylvania, other states that are dragging their heels. So it's unfortunate that it's going to go. I don't know what the major impacts will be. I think there's a chance for the progressive states and for communities to continue to move the agenda forward and maybe accomplish as much as what was originally envisioned under the Clean Power Plan.
And Dave Holmquist with the Citizens Climate Lobby, you had something to add?
Well, I agree with what Bill says about bringing the recalcitrant states along. But it's not a foregone conclusion that the Clean Power Plan will be scuttled. In the first place, it's in the courts right now. There's a pending decision from the D.C. Circuit Court on a challenge to the Clean Power Plan. And once that ruling is released, that case will go to the Supreme Court. They could end up upholding the Clean Power Plan. And even if they don't, with the current state of the law, the current state of the law is that the EPA has the obligation to regulate greenhouse gases. So if they take the dismantle the Clean Power Plan, they'll have to come up with something to replace it. And dismantling the Clean Power Plan will require at least 2 years of rulemaking, reverse rulemaking, hearings, public comment. This is something that it could take the entire administration, and they may just give up on it.
As it concerns the future energy jobs bill, I mentioned part of this was a bailout for the Exelon nuclear power plant near Clinton. Nuclear doesn't count as clean energy. Is it the waste issue? Is that the problem?
It's cost, waste, security. One of the reasons why nuclear energy costs so much is they need a small army to protect those plants. Now, they do a good job of doing that, but it's very expensive. And so if you go to any of our wind farms, they don't have a small security army protecting them. The major problem with nuclear power is that it's brittle power. And this comes from a major breakthrough work by Amory Lovins written back in 1984. The problem with nuclear power is it's so big. One of these plants goes down, you could be facing a blackout very quickly. The other problem is with global warming. These plants are in trouble because they need cooling water. And the water gets too hot, you have to shut down nuclear power plants. They've come close to doing that several times in this country. It's going to be a growing problem. They also absorb, they have to set aside huge amounts of water when this state's going to be facing drought in another 20 or 30 years. Wind and solar use no water. It's one of their major advantages. So again, if you look at the scheme of things, there is no future for nuclear power. There is no future for coal. Both of those are going by the wayside.
I want to circle back with Shannon for a moment. Something I forgot to ask you about the future energy jobs bill, and that's the job training factor in this. Can you talk a little bit about the level of job training that's included in this bill?
Sure. There is an allocation of funds. It's funded in kind of a different way than the rebates and the incentives associated with Future Energy Jobs Act, but there is a significant allocation of funds that will go toward job training opportunities for low-income populations specifically. And it's a really incredible opportunity for organizations, nonprofit organizations that have been ramping up for this opportunity and waiting and waiting and waiting for those actual jobs to come. And now is the time. Organizations like the Illinois Green Economy Network that are linked to the community colleges across the state have been developing these types of job training programs for the past decade, and they've just had to hold on until now. It is a real possibility for low-income populations. But the key is going to be to develop these programs in such a way that they really do reach these populations in a sustainable way.
Bill, was there something you wanted to add?
I'd like to say, one of the things we have to thank our own Illinois People's Action for helping to get those job provisions in the bill. They played a major role organizing environmental justice groups on the climate table to pick this up, because originally they weren't going to do it. This is a case where, again, political action helped to shape legislation in a more progressive direction.
One of the challenges is going to be to ensure that those funds get distributed broadly across the state and aren't concentrated up necessarily up in the Chicago area. And we're acting in advance of the rulemaking to make sure that happens.
A broad question for everybody here. What are some quick starts for people who want to do something right away to have an effect on global climate change, even if it's in their own small part of the world? And since we're talking to Shannon, we'll start with you.
I'm with the noise in the background.
Okay. I'll ask the question again. What are some quick starts for people who want to do something right away to have an effect on global climate change, even if it's in their own small part of their own world? What can they do individually to have an effect?
Certainly, I would say number one is to just get involved. You know, get involved with your local nonprofit organizations and learn and just be a part of the conversation. And secondly, you know, if you're interested in knowing what these renewable energy opportunities can do for you specifically, again, gain knowledge and educate yourself and engage in conversation with your legislators. people are often uncomfortable with doing that. And most times, you know, for example, in the solar industry, when we began speaking with legislators, every single person that we encountered was just very happy to have the conversation. This general knowledge about renewable energy just isn't there with most legislators, and they appreciate the conversation.
We have a couple of local elected officials sitting in on our roundtable. Are constituents engaging with you on this issue, Mayor Coos?
They are. It's definitely a concern, and they want to be helpful in the situation, and we get kudos for some of the projects that we do in the community. It's very much on their mind. You know, and cities, mayors and cities have a real opportunity here. 85% of the population of the United States lives in cities. And consequently, the jobs and the factories and the real energy users are clustered in cities. So mayors have a platform where they can do things locally that can make a huge difference. And they do it in as Terry has pointed out, U.S. Conference of Mayors and other organizations, they work on a national level.
Mayor Renner, same question. Constituents engaging with you?
Absolutely. There's definitely been an uptick since the election, since the presidential election, of people who are interested in a variety of issues, but especially global warming, climate change, the environment. And I would echo Shannon, just get involved, whether or not it's Illinois People's Action or it's a local organization, whatever you want to do, but stay involved. We've also had some increase in people on the other end who, again, aren't terribly interested in evidence because they've already drawn their conclusions, and that we are dupes of the United Nations and kinds of things like that. But it's a small but very vocal minority, and that's also something that we just have to be aware of. Human progress is not always linear, and there are almost always going to be people who are threatened by change.
And elections matter national, state, and local level.
National, state, and local level. That's what, get out and vote, get involved, be the leaders of tomorrow.
Bill Rao, the question is some quick starts for people who want to do something right away to have an effect on global climate change.
There's something people can do right away. If you own a home, I believe the Ecology Action Center has energy auditors, and you need to bring in an energy auditor because your home is probably inefficient, probably is leaking a heated gas or a heated air or a cooled air in the summer. And you can cut your carbon footprint very significantly by retrofitting your home and saving money in the process. So that's something people can do right now. There's just tremendous inertia here and people living in homes that have all sorts of things wrong with them. And I mean, I can go into a home and I can pick out things.
Incandescent light bulbs, for one.
Even fluorescent light bulbs. I mean, you've reached a point where LEDs use 50% less electricity than fluorescents.
And very affordable.
And they're affordable now. But I'm talking about things like open chimney chases that practically everyone has because it's fire code. Very easy to fix. You can do it in a couple hours with a couple bucks of material because you got just warm air just going right up that open chimney chase. There's just all sorts of things like that in homes that are costing energy and are increasing carbon.
Dave Holmquist, some quick starts.
Citizen engagement is where I come from. And I want to reiterate the fact that elected officials really like to hear from constituents on these issues. And at the national level, I think we're all a little jaundiced about the idea of the influence of money in politics. But these staffers in particular in congressional offices and the members themselves really, really enjoy sitting down with their constituents. And they're very welcoming, and it's a great experience to have. It's worth doing.
Okay, Dave Holmquist, thank you. Thanks to all of the panelists for participating in this Illinois Sustainable Living and Wellness Expo Climate Change and Community Action Panel. Also, thanks to Michael Brown, Executive Director of the Ecology Action Center, Illinois Wesleyan University, and Travis Metters, WGLT Broadcast Tech and Engineer, for today's edition of Sound Ideas. You can find this and past episodes of Sound Ideas at WGLT.org. That's also where you can subscribe to this podcast or find the Sound Ideas podcast at iTunes. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, email us at news@wglt.org, post at facebook.com/wglt fm, or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.